Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Legacy Tapes. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and this is a series of podcasts dedicated to examining how you can leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre, apparently. I'm here with Chris Good, who is, we're not quite sure what he is, we've just been chatting about it. He's a brilliant writer, director, contemporary performer, theatre maker, agitator, queer artist and do you claim activist?
I don't anymore. I used to.
Ex-activist. And now he's like, oh God, I'm exhausted.
Well, I'm not. I'm just... when I see what real activist... It's like why I stopped calling myself a sound designer as well, because then I met a sound designer. And I'm like, oh no, that's not what I do. I do a little bit of tinkering with, like...
I download things from YouTube.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
totally.
I'm that sort of activist.
Okay.
I have made theatre as a kind of activism, or I've tried to.
Yeah.
Sort of as a way of not then having to do any proper activism. I'm like, no, this is what I do. I do this thing.
But do you know what? I'm with you on that. Do you know how I phrase it? I phrase it that the world is woven of the stories we tell. So by weaving new stories into the fabric, you can change it.
Yeah, and that's a form of activism. That as well.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go as far as weaving and fabric.
Bollocks,
and stuff,
you literally called me out on my shit on my own fucking podcast. Shit, okay.
Yeah, we're off.
Where to begin? Tell me... I mean, I used to have regular, like, formal questions for this, and I've stopped doing that because it's better not to.
Yeah.
How did you get here? How did you, other than, like, by the train, how did you get to being in a place where making theatre was your was what you did? And also, it's so much part of, I feel like it's part of who you are. Like, what was that journey?
Lots and lots of... performance in an obviously really informal way as a kid, so school plays, but also just being the sort of annoying kid who would, you know, like show up at grown up parties and do the tap dance.
I did that.
We're gonna find out we're terribly similar.
Yeah, I used to tap dance to We're Walking in the Air by the Snowman on a tin tray in the living room.
Okay, I never did that, but I feel like I've elicited something from you that's very special. So that's good.
Yeah,
so I was that kid, sort of very shy, but also a sort of psychotic amount of chutzpah.
Yeah.
And just carried on being that, carried on being a show-off until, I suppose, sort of late in school, sort of coming up to sixth form, where I talk about this a lot because it was really important for me. I did a very unusual school play because like every so often they allowed one of the unusual English teachers to have a go at directing a school play, who was the sort of beardy radical guy.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I was in a really left-wing, new writing play. I wasn't in Oliver. I wasn't in Hobson's Choice anymore. I was in some real fucking theatre.
Right. And... can you remember what the play was?
Yeah, it was called The Earth Divided. It's by a guy called Mick Mangan, who's sort of mostly an academic now, a good writer. And it was a good play, and it was an enjoyable thing to do. I played a Puritan, so I had a great like outfit. And, I had cheekbones in those days, so I was looking pretty fly for a Puritan. And it brought out a certain amount of brimstone in me that you know has always been there. But more importantly, it was the first... everybody else in that room was older than me.
Yeah.
And they were all cooler than me.
Yeah.
And it was my first experience of doing that. And it was the first time that an emphasis was placed on being in a company, being together, being comrades.
Yeah.
And it was a sort of theatrical awakening or an aesthetic awakening or something, but it was also a political awakening at the same time. So those two things sort of got really entwined for me at that point.
Yeah.
And theatre then just became, I suppose, the natural home for all the things I wanted to do, partly because I wanted to do loads of different things. I was always writing, but I was also always making music, and I was always, you know, being the performy one. So everything that I wanted to do, I could take to theatre and make theatre contain those things. And so sort of went off to university, again, still very shy, very unconfident, sort of lower middle class, kind of like, I don't belong in this space. But what I could do, what I spent Freshers Week doing when everybody else was going to Cindy's for foam night, I was in my room writing a play that I could then take to the drama society and say, look, I've written a play, can we do a play? And that was a way of talking to people. It wasn't particularly about any ambitions to be a theatre artist at that point. I didn't know what I was going to do, but it was a way of going, hello, I'm interesting enough to talk to you. Or this play might be interesting enough to be a pretext for us to talk to each other. And I think that's what that's just set the tone for the last 25 years.
Yeah, it's like, here's the thing. Yeah, this is the shibboleth that gets me into the conversation.
That's it. That's exactly it. Yeah. And when I write myself down, I'm cooler and smarter and more in control.
Yeah.
And I don't blush as easily.
Well, everyone is, right? Because you get to edit out.
But also, I suppose I get to organise the world a little bit as well. I get to create an hour of world that I can live in more easily.
Yeah.
I think there was a huge thing about, you know, having spent my teenage years sort of low-level hyperventilating about the prospect of being a gay person, because that was the language I would have been using at that time, and feeling like my head was going to explode. And so those little pockets of space where it was possible to create an inhabitable world that didn't make me feel like my head was going to explode was what we would now call self-care.
Yes.
It felt like self-harm at the time, actually. It felt like sitting at home digging into the things that were painful.
Yeah.
But by doing that,
yeah,
you create breathing space and a kind of legitimacy for yourself, even if it's a legitimacy that's built out of secrets and provisional sorts of things. You get to be weird and you get to be in the center at the same time. Get to be faithful to your own weirdness, which at that point in my life was incredibly strong, but you also get to be the one in the middle you know.
So Rachel Briscoe, you know, once said to me that she thinks that theatre directors, for sure, and I think directing and writing, I think it all kind of blows, are people who learn to look at the world like outsiders.
Yes.
And then we look at it and we're like, oh, well, let's move it so that I'm either not an outsider or it's the world that I want to be part of.
Yeah, that's exactly what my therapist says as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good.
We say that to each other a lot.
Yeah. My therapist tells me that, because I've been doing more writing recently, and she's like, it's a good way for you to work through your shit. And then I write, at the moment I'm doing a thing about trauma. And fucking hell, it is working through my shit, but I don't like doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just you talking about sitting in that room doing self-harm. Like,
I totally
recognise that.
Yeah. Well, you have to... It becomes a way of paying attention to the thing. I mean, I think that's like... That's the... If I had to describe what I think I've done every day since then, it's about creating the conditions under which I can pay attention to the thing.
Right. That's a good way to put it. The thing. Stop. I'm going to stop this tap from dripping. And I'm going to... Great. Because that's how I do it. And I can edit that out, and it never happened.
Very good.
So tell me... Because you do loads... You do so much stuff. You're a proper polymath. And you've... run a venue and you've not run a venue and you've curated and not curated and I'm conscious that when I think of you now, it's as I do on Friday nights when it's lonely. like I think of you as someone who's really kind of carefully constructed their professional world to be the sort of world that you want to live in. So my question is as part of the journey from writing that first play in your student room while everyone was having fun at the phone party to through being independent into a venue and then out again, have you been aware of, like, do you give a shit about legacy? Are you leaving something? Is it always about looking at the thing? Or is it about leaving the looking at the thing for someone else to inform them? Like, do you care about legacy? Do you care about what's left?
I've really started to. Yeah, I didn't for a long time. And in fact, I was really militant about it because I realised really early on that the thing I loved most about theatre was its disappearing. I realised that was what gave it at least emotional meaning for me, was the fact that it disappeared. And I was very militant about that for a while. So when I was starting out, for example, I wouldn't allow the work to be documented in any way. I wouldn't allow photographs to be taken of it or anything like that, because I really seriously wanted it to disappear. And then I kind of climbed down from that ledge, because that's like...
That's hardcore.
And I really regret it now, to be honest. I wish I had, like, pictures of those things.
I did really good stuff, guys. I know. Honest.
But I felt like I had to be hair-shirty about it. I think I started to care about legacy actually in the run-up to turning 40. It was one of the signals that I gave myself that I was coming into middle age and middle career. Was going, what does this add up to?
There's a thing about mortality, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely. And I think I always comforted myself by going, I think I'm making the sorts of choices that on my deathbed, if I get a deathbed, I will go, well, I did the right things for the right reasons. I might have got lots of things wrong, but I did. I tried doing the right things. I gave my life to an honourable thing.
The quest was sound.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to be able to feel that. And then that started to feel like that wasn't quite... What was it? I have felt that until fairly recently. I have felt like I tried doing a good and noble thing, even when hardly anybody was interested, or when it was when it made my material life extremely hard. For example, those sorts of things. I think so. What I'm thinking about when I think about legacy is the book I wrote, because that was in a different space really than the, and it was about going, I want something that's going to stay on a shelf at that point.
Forest in the Field.
That's right. Yeah,
is the title for.
That's right.
Purchase minded listener.
And I kind of, you know, I'd had nothing published at that point except a couple of scripts and a couple of poetry chat books.
I mean,
and
nothing like, awful. Really, just like. But, four or five
but
things.
Those things go, you know, they just end up, you know,
they feel ephemeral,
you know, under Waterloo Bridge, like really fast. And I kind of stupidly I thought that to write an extended sort of critical thing, and it was partly because I was looking from, like, maybe I guess maybe my mid-30s, I was sort of looking around at my generation going, who's going to be the one who writes the book? Because it felt like we'd run out of book. Yeah. There wasn't a new book. Like, everyone was still reading The Fucking Empty Space. And I was like, what's going to be the next, you know, and who's going to be that person?
Yeah.
And nobody seemed to be into it.
It's got to be you.
So I was like, well, if I do it first, I get to say some things, right? So that's what I did. And I don't know, I feel sort of, I don't know that that does really count as legacy, because hardly anyone's bought it or read it. A few people have, and a few people, I think it's important to a few people, and maybe that's enough. But I did sort of think it might catch fire in a way that it hasn't.
I feel like that's the story of my life.
that's
contemporary theatre.
For me absolutely. So it's, you know, but it was worth a shot, it was worth doing. I disagree with most of that book now, but I'm really glad that that's
brilliant, right?
There. There's a weird sort of, it's weird having the wrong leg, but it's not the wrong legacy, because it was true of
at the time.
It was true at the time, and that's all I want to be. That's what I want to stand for, is having been a person who was trying to be thoughtful about the thing they were doing at the time they were doing it.
And I think there's a real, like, you know, I don't necessarily always agree with Schopenhauer, but I'm glad that he's in the canon for me to argue with mentally.
Absolutely. I'm really, my favourite bit of writing about theatre is a really short essay that is the preface to an edition of three plays by a guy called Paul Goodman, who was lots of other things other than a playwright, but really wanted mostly to be a playwright. And worked with the Living Theatre very early. So, like, in the early mid-50s, when Living Theatre was starting out, he was sort of like their house playwright for a bit. He writes really poignantly in that little essay about how theatre has not been willing to have him. That's the that's the phrase that he uses, that, you know, he wanted to be a person of theatre. Theatre wasn't willing to have him. And there's this really poignant thing where he says, well, maybe one day I'll be a statue in the park. And of course, now at this distance, you also know he's never going to be a statue in the park. But what I do know is that I found his book, and I think what he writes at the beginning of that book is the best, writing about theatre I've ever seen. And I've passed that on to maybe 20 other people who have learned from it. And maybe if, you know... So I don't need The Forest and the Field to be a bestseller. I need it to be... It really reminds me of when, I did quite a lot of work performing in people's homes early on. I haven't for a while, but I used to do that quite a lot. And it was a similar sort of feeling of, like, there's only 10 people here.
But they're going to carry this with them.
8 of these people will remember that they did this.
I think that's a thing that I think about a lot. Again, it's a Rachel Briscoe. I spend too much time with that woman, apparently. and it's that sense of meaning. Like, we so think of... For a long time, I thought of meaning and value as kind of existing at the point of reception. And I've said that to lots of people a lot. I've been like, no, this is what I think is true. And actually, Rachel was like, well... That once it's gone into those people, they carry it with them for the rest of their lives. And in 50 years, this thing that was nothing will mean something to them. And I sort of didn't, I mean, I partially agreed with her at the time. And then the more I think about it, the more I realise that like, there are things that I've seen that I dismissed or I didn't care about or I was just damn fucking angry at and have carried them with me in such a way that they're these treasures. And I'm, you know, I hope that, I'm sure your work does that. I'm sure there are people who, like, there are things that I've seen of yours that I carry with me as treasures. So at least you've got, like, a one other person's lifetime, right? If not. You're not quite on the Ramesses scale.
No.
But maybe.
But I think I really... I so like not knowing as well. I like the feeling that I've put something out in the world. That's what I'm trying to keep doing, is putting things out in the world, and they do what they're going to do. And it's impossible to track, and maybe that's the version of legacy that also does ephemerality, is you have to lose the thread of it. You put the thing out, and then it's...
And the ripples go.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Ripply threads.
Okay. Yes. I'm going to ask, so tell me a little bit about, because you're like, in, so we had a little conversation a while ago about your place relative to some of your contemporaries, like in your kind of, in your Cambridge year group or your Cambridge, I don't know, cohort, because, it's all right, it's, you know, I'm going to keep it oblique. How do you, like, because one of the things that I'm super conscious of is the difficulty of maintaining the kind of purity of tone, that sounds really wanky, but, like, just keeping your own voice when you feel like you have, when you feel like there's a reason to say something in terms of leaving something. And I find myself really struggling to do that and not do the thing, and not actually just say the thing that the dude that graduated at the same time as me says, and he earns a decent living. and yeah, that's the best way to say it. And like, because you're from, because there's that kind of, I mean, if you come through Oxbridge anyway, you're going to be part of one of the golden generations. What's that like to be like? Because people have such different tastes to you in your cohort. And is that a thing you think about? Is that a thing you don't think about?
I think it's really shaped what I've done and who I've been. In that, I think I learned. So really, it's sort of the extension of the I'm too shy for this, and therefore I'm going to go back to my room and prepare to be a genius, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
because if it's only me in the room, someone thinks I'm a genius, right? with you on that.
I'm at the end of sixth form, I got into comedy writing. That was going to be my thing. So the big thing that was on my mind when I went off to Cambridge was that I was going to do Footlights, that I was going to be in the Footlights and go through that route and be essentially David Mitchell.
Yeah.
Who's a little bit younger than me, but that was, you know, that was the sort of place I thought I'd occupy in the culture. Yeah. Except I wrote songs as well, so...
Okay,
so... Bit of David Mitchell, bit of Victoria Wood. Yeah. Like, somewhere in the middle,
I'd be Victoria Wood if someone would let me.
No, right, I know. That's who I thought I was going to be, and then I started trying to go along to auditions, and I was always in a queue behind vastly confident, entitled, upper-middle-class boys who knew that they belonged in that queue, and I never did, and I always went home again.
Yeah.
And I think what that did was it obliged me to make my own work out of the way and just try and make it vivid enough that it was unignorable. So it was like sort of setting fire to something in the corner of the room and going, but you're going to have to pay attention to me now because this thing is on fire.
The fucking curtains are on fire, guys.
And I never, you know, in the same way that I was never part of Footlights, I was never part of the sort of theatre establishment at Cambridge. I never... Sort of, I rarely worked in even the big college venues. It was always sort of little out of the way sort of spaces, doing really small things for fairly small audiences. But that was super exciting. Mm. And I realised that people talked about my work in a different way than they talked about the work that did occupy those more sort of mainstream spaces. And I've just sort of carried on doing that, not deliberately, but just temperamentally. That's who I am. Mm. I didn't have the confidence when I graduated to then sort of put myself out there. So it took a really long time to get a foothold. I moved to London, and then I worked really quietly for quite a long time doing the same sort of thing and waiting for anyone to notice. And I've just sort of carried on doing that. And I think what I feel now, like in the last few years, I've been really lucky that there's been a bit of momentum around me as an artist and around having a company structure. I mean, that made a huge difference. But honestly, like that sense I had of a trajectory of slowly moving upscale.
Yeah.
I now feel like I've definitely sort of hit my head on that ceiling and I don't think that's going to be the thing that motivates me anymore. I'm not sure where I am with my practice at all right now, but I don't... Like, the last big thing I made, which was Jubilee, I made this show for initially for the Royal Exchange, and it came into the Lyric. And that was the biggest cast I'd worked with since I was an undergraduate, and a big company, huge project for someone like me who makes work really for people's kitchens, you know.
Yeah.
And it was really exciting to do it, but it was also incredibly bruising. I felt really sore afterwards. And although I was really proud of that show, I was not, I think, super proud of the process, because it wasn't my process, really. It's the attention thing. It's the paying attention thing.
Mm.
My process and my life as an artist is about trying to be really close to things. And at a certain level of bigness, that closeness, it doesn't scale up.
Yeah.
And I didn't enjoy that. I enjoyed the gestures of that piece, and I loved having a bigger canvas. I loved I think there's a huge thing for me about simultaneity, about being able to make more than one thing happen on stage at the same time. Mm-hmm. And being able to do that has been fairly rare in my career. Mm-hmm. So there are things that I really love aesthetically and politically as well about working at that sort of scale.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that I'm not close and I'm not excited about that as a mode of working.
It's not intimate.
If I could find a way, that's exactly it. If I could find a way of, maybe there is a way of reconciling what I want with scale. I hope there might be, but I also...
Maybe it's telly.
I think it's really not for me. I think it really could be for other people, but I think it's really not for me.
Okay. Because I also struggle with it, because I really care about detail and the moment where you see something in change without knowing what it is, and you can't do that at the Lyric, is too big. Mm. So because it's super interesting listening to you talk about, you know, this sense of being kind of the outsider, or the kid in his bedroom doing the thing, and kind of that's one of the things I loved about Wound Man, was that this kid in his bedroom with a universe, essentially, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And yet, like, I totally think of you, and I certainly, the first kind of few times we met, it was quite a long time ago now, I remember being, feeling like you were one of the grown-ups. Like, and so I'm sort of curious about what it is to hold both that kind of outsider status, which you do, the work you make, and that is totally authentic and true, and also be making work for the Exchange and the Lyric and the Court, which are not outsiders. They are beyond inside.
Mm.
You know, they're the really the cool kids. What is that? What's the tension between that?
Well, let's start with the thing about, I totally didn't feel like a grown-up until, maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And that almost exactly coincides with the point in my career where, for the first time, I was thinking, also, I don't really know what I'm doing.
Mm.
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Because I was formulating for years about... I always felt like I was at the kids' table at the wedding reception, with my knees up around my ears.
I'm tinkering around with form. Sorry, guys. It's like the kid that's puked on its shirt,
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I think, I think people in key positions in the industry didn't take me seriously, or they had a very limited sense of what I do, what I've done, or a very caricatured sense of what I do, what I'm capable of doing. I suspect that's true of most people. Don't think nuanced versions of most artists exist in the minds of most programmers.
Yeah.
I think, there is some, even after that, even when I started taking work into bigger spaces, and like you're saying, like the cool grown-ups, there's a sense that there's some policing that happens around that I think I find really uncongenial. Like, one of the worst things about making Jubilee was getting notes, because I've hardly ever in my life had to deal with that. And the same with sort of anything I've it's been peculiar being me, because I've spent so much time yelling at the establishment about how shit they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also going, so give me a gig. And it's only relatively recently that I've realised what an unappealing combination that is for them, and that it takes a certain kind of bravery to...
Yeah.
To give the person a gig who is saying, you're all a bunch of wankers, and,
Yeah, I have exactly, on a different scale, I have exactly that experience.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I write shitty articles for The Guardian, being like, you're all cunts. Yeah. Please hire me to direct your next summer smash hit.
Yeah. So I think there is absolutely a tension about that. And I think What I've realised, I'm not sure if this is a good answer to your question from some minutes ago, but what I've realised is how annoying I am. I didn't know that I was an annoying person until fairly recently, but I think okay. I am. I think I... because I think I do that. I think I'm really friendly with people, and then I really piss them off because I'm pursuing some thing, some right. vision ideal. Of a thing
yeah.
that they... that just makes their life so much harder. Or
and everyone wants an easy life.
Well, I think... do you know what? To be really candid, one of the things that got me thinking about this was how little repeat business I get.
yeah.
That I work yeah, a yeah. lot of places once. Yeah.
Okay. Right?
And there have been some exceptions to that. Mm. There have been some relationships that have been important.
You definitely worked twice with us.
Yes, that's
for sure. I remember it. There was a cat
yeah.
and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. But so I mean, that's interesting in itself. But,
yeah.
Because I remember when I came to you... when you were fairly new at Oval House, one of the things that I said to you was, I don't have a home.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And
yeah.
Oval House actually is as close as I've had to a home.
Oh, that's good.
Which is really nice, and that continues with Owen, and that's really, yeah. that's super nice. But that feeling of, I don't know who my guys are, I don't... I sort of do in the, you know, you come up with people and you those of us who persist,
yeah.
you have a sense that
eventually there are 10 of you that are still there, so you yeah. must be a group.
But then also yeah. I've had a fairly bumpy couple of years from that point of view, and I feel like lots of those relationships are not the relationships they once were.
Mm.
And I sort of, again, I don't, and also I'm not doing a great job of reintroducing myself to the younger generation where all of the energy currently is. And I see people doing a much better job of that than I am.
Yeah.
And
it's not me.
Yeah, it takes a kind of, again, that thing that I was saying I've not really had of the being willing to be self-presenting.
Mm.
You know, going, oh, you should know about me because that's not me.
Yeah.
I do struggle with that. But it's really clear that actually the proportionally... the number of people working in the sector who know who I am and what I'm doing is shrinking again.
Yeah.
It went up for a while and now it's yeah. coming down again. And I have to have a think about that. Yeah. I have to have an attitude about that.
And it's hard because I'm a bit younger than you, but I'm finding that right now as well.
Mm.
And it is hard.
Mm.
Like from this time where people used to be like, oh, you do that cool thing.
Yeah.
And knowing my face because I was on Twitter or something,
right? Right, yeah.
And now to being like, oh, I sometimes do this,
yeah.
And it's tricksy because yeah. you never, because if you spend all of the conversation explaining we all right to have a place yes. in the conversation,
yeah.
you never get to actually have the conversation, whatever yeah. that is.
And I think a newer thing, newish thing,
mm.
is that the people you're talking to in that moment are also going to be much bolder about asking who you are
mm.
and why you have the right to say the things that you're saying.
Yeah.
And that's super interesting as well. I don't object to that at all,
yeah.
but it is exhausting.
because I've earned it.
Well, because we all of this conversation in a way has been about like pushing the fucking boulder up the hill, and you kind of think you're going to get to a point where maybe you get to just stand there for a moment before yeah. the boulder rolls down again. And
yeah, can I give you another Rach Briscoe special?
Please do, yes.
Hey, Rach.
This is a twofer. This is really nice.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's it's something about if you're Prometheus, what you have to do. Do I mean Prometheus? Sisyphus.
Yes.
Christ. What you have to do is learn to enjoy the walk down.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, yes. Like, off we go again.
Yes. Yeah, 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 yeah.
But at least there's a view.
Mm.
And like yeah,
wildfires. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've really unexpectedly made a fucking awful job of crashing into midlife and mid-career in a way that, like, nothing that came before that suggested that I would do it so badly.
Mm.
So I'm so interested in whether this moment is survivable, whether it's sustainable, how much I want to invest in, like, until very... like, this time last year,
yeah.
if you'd said to me, your future might not be in theatre,
Yeah.
I could not possibly have believed that for a moment.
Yeah.
Like, all of my eggs were in that basket.
Yeah.
And they still are. But I'm beginning to notice that there are also empty baskets available.
See, this is super interesting talking to you because I'm also experiencing exactly that.
Yeah.
Like, it has always been such a big part of who I am. Like, not just a vocation, but a need.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, well, I'd make a really good, craft potter.
Mm.
Maybe I'll do that.
Mm.
And that, just the presence of that question...
Mm.
And the presence of that, because I find that the work of being part of this ecology has gone up exponentially.
Yes.
And there are some things that are good. There's something like it's right that people have to justify their voice of authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But it also, in an industry that isn't sustainable, it makes it even less sustainable for the people who are also carrying the weight of making a living or of dealing with anything, any kind of mental illness or any kind, just anything more than existing in this space.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, maybe I should go somewhere where all I have to do is exist in the space.
Mm. Yeah, it kind of, I don't know whether it's about just a sort of a cumulative feeling of being battered by being beaten up by having done this for 25 years and but also I think there are shifts happening both in the wider culture and in our bit of the sector as well, in a really concentrated way, and lots of those changes are super important and super overdue, but I'm not sure where I'm not sure what my place is in relation to those things. And I think, I don't know, I used to look at theatre like it was sort of a shelter, right? That would be a place where I would go and I would feel okay. And and it hasn't been that for a few years.
Yeah.
At all.
It's not a place of safety.
It's not a place of safety. I think I don't want it to be a place of safety. I think I feel stifled by that. And partly I've got myself into trouble by not valuing safety very much,
right?
But there is a breathable air in being able to take certain kinds of risks together, or that sort of thing. That's a pedantic thing,
but no, it's important. Because actually, but, I hate. Yeah, go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I what the feeling I have right now, and I think it's. So my company has been in quite a tricky place lately, and maybe we can talk about that a bit.
Yeah.
But also I had a really bruising experience, and it's an experience that that everybody has, and I've had it before in other contexts, of being commissioned to write a play that then didn't make it. But the way that experience panned out across a couple of years was so demoralizing.
Mm.
There was such dishonesty in it. And I think where I come to is more than ever, I think this has always been an interesting problem for me that just got less interesting.
Yeah.
Is a feeling of the theatre industry is at war with theatre.
Yes.
The theatre industry is at war with what I mean
by theatre.
By theatre,
because industry and theatre,
aren't
actually things.
I think there are ways of doing it, but it would take a massive amount of reorganisation. And I think I always wanted to stand for that possibility, which is why I was interested in doing work in people's homes or different kinds of spaces or different kinds of organisation. But actually, the industry is also bashing back in relation to a lot of that stuff, because we're being more careful about how professionalised we are.
Yeah.
About there being protocols around.
Can I be pedantic?
Stuff. Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
Because there's a thing. Yeah. There's a thing about that professionalised.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Like, it sits next to ideas around mitigating risk.
Yes.
And the thing that I care about, the thing that adds to the sum of human knowledge, the thing that makes me leave this theatre space, this place, this performance experience, thinking and seeing differently, is something that hasn't existed long enough to be professionalised.
Yes.
And so I think, whereas I absolutely think there's a duty of, like, we have a duty of care to each other, let's just not be dicks.
Yes, yes, yes.
There also has to be a degree of going, well, actually, for this to exist, there has to be, it's built on wild card. It's it's a wild card house, right? Mm-hmm. That's how it functions.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I just wanted to be a bit pedantic about that sense of professionalisation because...
No, I totally agree. And I think... how am I going to say this? Like, all through my career, I've come to theatre with certain questions about, like, can we live differently? Can we be with each other in a different way? Can we change what the fundamental properties of our relationships are? That's why I go to work with these questions.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's an answer now, and the answer is no. And that answer comes from the industry that I'm trying to work
in. Oh, fuck, that hurts, though.
Yeah. But that's how that... So, really specifically, the reason I feel like this is because last year, as a result of... some dispute around a project that I had run for some time, a really avowedly sort of difficult, challenging project, but one that seemed to me to be flourishing also and not unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the aftermath of that project finishing, some people had some important things to say about it not having been their experience, that it was okay. And as part of dealing with that, we had to sort of suspend my company for a while we appointed someone to lead an independent investigation into essentially into my practice as a director. And there was a report at the end of that process, and it's a report that has a lot of very useful things to say about how to not get into trouble again.
Yeah.
It says a bunch of useful things. And I shouldn't say it like that, because it also basically is saying, here's how not to hurt people again.
Mm.
And I have to take that. I do take that really seriously. Mm. And I understand now, in a way that I didn't understand even 6 months ago, that I genuinely did hurt people really inadvertently by misunderstanding a bunch of things about power, about difficulty, about queerness. Like, there were a bunch of things that I didn't know, and because I didn't know those things, because I didn't have a clear picture of those things, I had bad information out of which I made bad choices.
Yeah.
All in a, the most sort of attentive and thoughtful, caring,
well-meaning way.
So I'm not... I was genuinely grateful for this report that says... You know, and it did come from a place of going, this is not about stopping you working, this is about going, if you're going to carry on working, this is the context, and this is what we need to put around everything. Mm. At the same time, the values of that report were not neutral. They were presented, obviously, as if they were like, well, we're just doing professional care and responsibility and whatever. But every one of those findings and recommendations has an ideological basis that is absolutely not acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that that report sort of prohibits, in a sense, is that when I go to work, I might have questions that could involve different kinds of social organisation or different kinds of thinking about power.
Mm.
Because in order to do the work safely, there has to be incredible clarity and fixity around those questions about power and those questions about authority and who is heard and how, you know. It's super, like, it never occurred to me that it was an expression of my privilege to be going into a room as a person of the anarchist left and trying to think through those principles in a room and go, well, in that case, are there things that we can do to make the power situation here, or the group situation, whatever it is, more dispersed? Can I lean on your autonomy more? Can we take responsibility for ourselves in a different way? Can there be play around these ideas? I think I didn't know that for people who have been consistently disempowered, disenfranchised, or not given authority, those sorts of confusions are actually not helpful.
Yeah, they're difficult.
They're really hard.
Yeah.
I think I thought they were a gift. I think I thought, hey, it doesn't have to be this way, so we'll throw it all up in the air. But actually, quite a lot of the people that I've been working with lately are going, no, I want to understand what my relationship is with you, and ideally I'd like that to be written down somewhere so that I can know what it is.
Yeah.
And I absolutely get that now in a way that I wouldn't have done 6 months ago, but I also don't know what to do with it as a director, because a fundamental part of my practice, the fundamental part of my practice, is going into the room with those questions.
Yeah.
Partly, I think, it's just about trying to refine an understanding of power that allows it to be given away even more. But at the same time, there's clearly a need or an appetite for a kind of clarity and a kind of rigidity that also just doesn't fucking appeal to me. Because it's like, when it was so important for me really early on doing my 3 years at kind of People's Theatre.
Yeah.
Going into that, I was not particularly a sort of devisey sort of person. I mean, I was, but CPT in those days was tribal. It was like, we do devising, we don't do new writing, we don't do scripts, we do devising.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that we do that is because we think the way that we make work should reflect our political commitments.
Yeah.
And no one had really properly expressed to me, I'd had that experience at school of going, oh, actually, we can all be socialists together.
Yes.
As sixth formers, we can be very cool socialist kids.
Yeah.
But no one had gone, so then that changes what it means to be a director. Mm. It changes what it means to say you are an actor. It changes what a script is or isn't.
Yes.
Or what it should and shouldn't.
And it changes every relationship and every...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. And those questions have become the core of how I think of myself as an artist.
Mm.
And I'm not sure that they have a viability any longer in the space that I'm familiar with. So there is a task now for me about either figuring out what that new space looks like or getting the fuck out and letting other people like push the boulder up the hill for a while.
Yeah. I have some unfocused thoughts about that might become focused as I loudly think them, which is... because I shout a lot. I mean, just take a degree of abstraction when I'm talking about your specific situation, but I shout a lot about, I mean, capitalism.
Yes.
Capitalism and authoritarian hierarchies. Join the club. and one of the things that perpetually frustrates me is the inability, if everything about you has grown within a system, the inability to imagine anything outside that structure. I find incredibly, incredibly frustrating. And I think the same applies to these ideas of who has power. Because if you have learned just about to survive in this structure, you really don't want anyone to fuck with the structure. And in the short term, that's super, super useful because it means that you are protected. But in the long term, it means we're all fucking stuck in this structure.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't... I mean, I'm going to be dead before anything changes. But I would hope it isn't always going to be like this. Like, it, you know, just the broader... Like, you know, the broader social assumptions around value and hierarchy and power... like, it's super difficult, isn't it, to be able to question and seek innovation or change while also being obligated not to challenge. I've just repeated what you said.
You're absolutely right. And we're in this, it's so interesting. I feel like a prophet who got everything wrong. You know, because I felt like, and this is what the book is about, and this is why I'm mildly embarrassed about the book now, because it felt like it was predicting a shift that we've actually stepped away from. Because
doesn't mean it isn't.
Our focus right now, not improperly, is on who has power. It's not so much on what that power looks like or how it works when people attain it. So, you know, here we are, we're talking the week after everything kicked off with Tree, for example, which is a really interesting
It's an incredibly interesting case study.
Sort of example of exactly this. And a lot of people feeling very hurt because they're looking at figures in that situation and going, we thought you represented change.
And it, and actually, the thing is, because you have the choice, we have the choice to agitate either for a change of who gets to wield the power in the fucked up oppressive power structure, or we get to change the fucked up oppressive power structure. And I think we often confuse the two. And I think we're, I agree with you, we're totally in an era where what we're doing is we're changing the aesthetics of the fucked up oppressive power, but it's still there. And I think that I've been feeling quite disenchanted with everything. Just fuck it all. With everything.
Glad I came.
Sorry, I did offer you a biscuit. I'm feeling quite disenchanted with kind of everything and struggling to find hope in the long, like in looking at like what the world might be or what the arts ecology might be, because they smush up for me and I think about it. And it's because this thing that I have been a foot soldier in, this fighting for change and this agitation for it not always being like, you know, the floppy haired Oxbridge posh boys or whatever, or it not always looking, people not always making the same value assumptions or cultural assumptions. Like, I fought for that, and now I get here, and those changes are sort of happening, but they're happening in the least meaningful way. And now I'm like, well, that was 20 years of my life. And the next 20 years, can I bear to keep doing this?
So I've had to pull my my Edinburgh show because of everything that's going on with the company. But I was making a show that was actually sort of looking back over the last 25 years and thinking about changes, particularly in queer culture in that time, and what it meant to me, you know, as a in my early 20s, sort of coming out into a cultural situation, and where that. Where that's gone, where the traces of that now are, and how, you know, I think queerness means something very different now, in, or it means lots of different things, but hardly even one of them is what I mean.
Do you want to tell us what you mean?
And it was, maybe, I'm going to finish this thought first, which is, in writing this script, about reflecting on all of those things, I found myself saying, in a way that I didn't intend to and I didn't know I was going to, saying quite baldly, I think lately I've lost hope. And I hadn't heard myself say that in quite that way. And there's a bit of me that's super interested in what theatre is if it's not a place or a crucible of hope. I've been talking a lot about lamentation with people. I've been going, Yeah. Is this where we come to grieve? Is this where we come to...
Maybe this is the place for a Greek chorus.
Yeah. Like, that. There's something... I can get that. I can get with that. Mm. Because I don't see, in the way that I used to, the idea that people coming together is in itself a hopeful thing. Because I think we see people come together in incredibly hopeless and futile ways all the time. And I think there's a weird liberal delusion around the idea that theatre is intrinsically a hopeful gathering.
Yeah.
It takes a kind of showing up, but only in relation to the kind of work that you and I are interested in, and that's not what most theatre is. Mm-hmm. And theatre is at war with that.
Yeah.
The industry is at war with that space. So it becomes incredibly fragile and dissident, and maybe that in itself is hopeful, but I kind of feel like... I got really interested in... I've always hated the formulation of theatre as a sacred space, but something about it was sort of on my mind a bit a while ago, just going, what does that actually mean? What are we actually talking about? And I did a little bit of an etymological dig, which is what I do when a concept has suddenly become interesting to
me. What does it actually mean?
And in that list of kind of root meanings of sacred is the idea of being cursed. And I'm feeling quite energised by the idea of theatre as a cursed space. Mm. You know, what does it mean if we gather there in the knowledge that our gathering is futile? It's hard to... I don't know, it's hard to like... twirl a baton in relation to that idea. It's hard to say hooray at the end of that sentence.
Where's the glitter cannon?
But is there something about our need to come together and acknowledge lamentation and loss and the things that we have broken and destroyed? Or is that just me at the age of 46 going, ow, you know?
Because
also when I see the companies that I really like coming through, where everybody's in their early 20s, mid-20s or whatever.
Hopeful prime.
The hope in that work is massive and beautiful. And maybe also then it's just time for old cunts like me to get out of the way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to do.
No.
What should we do?
Dude, I don't know. If I knew, I'd have done it.
I know,
and,
right?
And, you know, I'm almost exactly 10 years younger than you, and I'm in a really similar place. And I think there's something about... like, I felt like I spent a lot of time... It's so hard, isn't it? I spent a lot of time as a younger person being like, would all the old cunts just fuck off? Like, who is it? Was it Pete... is it Peter Hall ran the Arts Theatre when he was 23?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't... I've said this a million times on this podcast. You can't imagine a 23-year-old being asked to do anything of that standing these days.
No.
And as a younger person, I was like, fuck, can you all go away?
Yeah.
And now, I still haven't... The world hasn't been what I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And I'm not an elder. I haven't been afforded any of the comforts of being an elder.
Yes.
And yet I have the exhaustion of being an elder. And what is that? And is there a value in being the person there going, actually, all of this change that we fought for was the wrong fucking change. Start again. Stop being dicks. Let's talk about complexity instead of absolutism and authoritarianism. Because, I mean, you said an interesting thing just there about, well, a while back, about this liberal delusion. And because I find myself perpetually caught these days between my instinct to fight for the left and my instinct to fight authoritarianism. Because for so long, we talked about that as one horizontal axis, and it's actually a cross, right?
Yes.
And I'm having to leave behind, I think, in order to continue to function in the world, I'm having to leave behind some of the left shit because I need people to continue to be allowed to be themselves. And I've forgotten where I'm going. And that, like, I, you know, even with some of my very closest, you know, people that I love dearly, artists that have been friends for years, that has become my choice of liberalism as the priority has become a point of contention.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that there isn't, like, there is one artist that I've worked with really closely and we cannot talk about it without arguing.
Yeah, yeah.
There isn't a space for a discussion. And I feel like it's a microcosm of where, I mean, the world is, but certainly where the theatre ecology is in terms of we can't, we don't know how to talk about differing values. Like, we're back to the tragedy of the commons, and for fuck's sake, there are lots of very interesting philosophical writings about that. Because I feel like the discourse has become an orthodoxy, it's very difficult to find place to say, well, hang on, could it be different and better this way? Because we're so busy fighting for the one we've all chosen. Yeah, I mean, that's all. I'm just lamenting. I'm lamenting. Let's lament. Hooray.
Maybe it's all just going to be about podcasts now. Podcast lamentation.
Yeah, I had a lamentation yesterday because weirdly, like, someone emailed me to be part of this podcast, and I've been trying to get them to email me to give me a job for about a decade.
Right, right, right.
And I was like, oh, okay, so this thing that I do that is just a rumination and is unpaid, that's the thing you value. The thing that's actually I'm highly trained and skilled at.
Yes.
This is just me recording me talking shit.
Yeah.
That's what you want? Oh, fuck's sake. So, yeah, I definitely had a lamentation about the podcast. Okay, so we've been talking for about an hour, so I should probably stop talking. But the last question I always ask is, when you go from this place, this either theatre or this astral plane, what do you want to have left behind? What do you want people to say about you, or what do you want to be changed?
I think what I want is that thing I described earlier of, like, when I think about the people who... Well, so I'm just going to pause and name the fact that this is premised on the idea that I want to change people's lives.
Right. Let's just assume that as standard, yes.
I think I still want that even... You know, and for the better.
even post bruising.
Even post bruising, I think that's a reflex. I think that's a that's something that happens sort of precognitively, but at least by this point. But I think I increasingly trust that idea that I sort of invoked earlier about I would like to be the chapbook on the shelf, you know, the little pamphlet that doesn't even have a spine, that you pick it off and you look at it and it's all like fucked up and like blotchy, and like, but you open it and you read a paragraph and you go, fuck
yeah,
because so many important artists did that for me, and none of them are household names, none of them are at the Royal Court, none of them have any real kudos except for the 20 people who then pass that little booklet around and go, fuck. I don't know. I think it's a hard question to answer without being sounding a bit like it makes everything pious. But if I could choose, then I think I'd much rather be that than anything else. I'd rather be it's the legacy equivalent of performing in people's kitchens, which I did for so long, and going, that only played to 10 people tonight, but 8 of them will always remember it.
I've been thinking a lot about the tiny heroism of unremarkable lives. Right, just you know, just the sheer glory of carrying on. And I think there's something about, like, what you've just said about something that it is about being ephemeral, but or being just unephemeral enough to be really meaningful for a few people. It's probably better than being lasting and unmeaningful for 1,000. Well, I don't know.
No, I think that's right. I think that's... Can I tell you something really sort of...
Yeah.
What's the word? I don't think it's arrogant, but it's a little bit.
Dude, swing your dick around. Let's go.
I will feel when I leave here,
yeah.
when I do go from this place, yes. i.e. your kitchen,
yeah.
this will be the thing I feel squeamish about. But
right.
it's still quite new in my head because it only happened 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So I've been rereading a book that was exactly that sort of incendiary book.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered it when I was an undergraduate and hadn't read it for a long time. It's a book called Bomb Culture
mm-hmm.
by a guy called Jeff Nuttall,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the early founders of The People Show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book from 68, I think. So it's in this weird moment of CND plus traditional jazz,
yes.
right? And that's yeah. where that's the shit that's going to save the world at that yeah. point. And Nuttall is a poet and a performance artist. And I met him once towards the end of his life, just this kind of life force, right?
Yeah.
Most of what he has to say in 1968 is completely unacceptable now. But there's an energy about it,
yeah.
and the language that he uses is so exciting. And so I did a little Google on Jeff Nuttall because I haven't thought about him for a really long time. Mm. And I thought, I bet there's some interesting things sort of out there. And like 15 or 18 Google pages down where I'm sort of starting to flag.
Yeah.
There's this one book that comes up on Google Books, you know, when you can see the text of,
yeah.
of books. There is an index to a book about poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Where the entry for Bob Cobbing, who's another great hero of mine, says, just underneath it, see also Chris Good, Jeff Nuttall.
So you get to be one of them.
So I, just being in that lineage,
yeah.
even on one page of one book that
yeah.
20 people are going to read, like, that tells me that I showed up
yeah.
at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pleasing.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything you want to say? Because I always feel like whenever we talk in quite like abstract, we often talk in abstract terms.
Mm.
Something that you feel like you haven't said or you want to clarify or you...
No, I mean, I think I will probably go through a wave of feeling uncomfortable about some of the things we said. Not because it was candid, but because I don't like the idea... I think it would be really possible to hear this conversation and hear entitlement in it. Mm. And I think there probably is. I think it's a slightly different entitlement. I don't think it's the entitlement of floppy hair in Oxbridge. I think it's the entitlement of, God, we worked hard. And what was that all about?
Can we please have a rest?
But also, you know, is there a space in which we can carry on
yeah.
making the work that has... Yeah. made our hearts beat for the last however long. So I hope it doesn't sound entitled in that sense. I am in some ways an old fart, and in some ways I'm not, but maybe all old farts say in some ways they're not.
You know that you know that Simpsons meme, old man yells at cloud?
Yeah.
maybe you're that. Maybe instead of you're yelling at the...
I kind of feel like if I get the next 20 years right, I'll be the cloud.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. Thank you very much, Chris Good.
Thanks for having
me. Hi, it's Rebecca again. Thanks for listening. Just a quick reminder that if you like the episode and you like what we do, please do pop over to patreon.com/thelegacytapes and consider making a donation to help us keep doing it and doing it better. Thanks a lot.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.